Hey everyone, and welcome to this, a Soapbox Chat here on Risky Biz with our good friend Zane Lackey. My name's Patrick Gray. The Soapbox podcasts here on Risky Biz are our special editions. We run them once a month or thereabouts, and they're wholly sponsored, which means, yes, the vendor you're about to hear from paid to participate in this conversation. But as you'll soon discover, hopefully, that doesn't mean this conversation will suck. What you're about to hear is a long-form interview that I did with Zane Lackey, a former pen tester turned director of security engineering for Etsy, turned co-founder and chief security officer of Signal Sciences. Signal Sciences can be broadly, kinda, sorta described as next generation WAF. So if you do have a requirement for a WAFy, raspy thing, then yeah, you absolutely need to check out Signal Sciences. They're good for giving you visibility into attacks against your applications and even auto-blocking a bunch of them without that turning into a shit show, basically, which is what happens when you turn auto-blocking on with a lot of, you know, conventional WAFs. And yeah, Signal Sciences product has a really strong, puts really strong emphasis on assisting organizations who are running DevOps shops. And it makes sense because Zane's key achievement when he was at Etsy was managing the security of that company's DevOps transition. And he's actually just written an O'Reilly book called Building a Modern Security Program, which is about those types of transitions. So he joined me to talk about his book, what's in it, about DevSecOps more generally, and of course, about some new stuff Signal Sciences has been working on. Here's my interview with Zane Lackey.
Yeah, so I've got an O'Reilly book coming out that I'm super excited about. I think it's a milestone for anyone in tech, let alone in security, and it's just something I've always kind of wanted to do for my entire career. Even going back to when I was a complete nerd in high school, reading O'Reilly books on the bus to school and everything.
So what's the book about?
It's really out of lessons learned about how do you shift a security program and a security team to really adapt to DevOps. And I think for a lot of folks, the temptation, and this was certainly something I messed up at first as well, is that the temptation is at first to just try to treat it as a change of technology and try to, what are the new technologies we buy or anything there. But the lesson I really had to learn was the much bigger changes are really cultural. And how does a security team really structure itself? How does it interact with the rest of the business? And what does it think about providing to the rest of the business? And how does it try to affect change inside that business as well? So it's really a collection of lessons learned out of that, kind of split up into different chapters of kind of how do you drive culture? How do you kind of restrict access without causing cultural problems? How do you create really good feedback loops and other kind of pieces like that?
So, I mean, it is, by the sounds of things, a book about how to get from A to B, to get from this state to that state. And I'm imagining that you had a type of organization in mind when you wrote it in terms of the before and the after. Tell us about what the before looks like as you envisioned it, the pre-DevOps, shop.
At the end of the day, I really wrote the book almost to myself in the sense that this is something I wish I could have read at the start of our journey into DevOps. Way back in my previous CISO role, that is. And so it was really around, look, you're an organization going through this journey to DevOps. And I think the reality that I've really seen out there is, regardless of the size of enterprise, from the largest enterprise down to the smallest startups, they're embracing DevOps, but everyone's doing it at kind of different speeds and in slightly different ways. But what has changed so much in the last, really, I'd say 3 to 5 years is that everyone recognizes that they're on this path now. It is extremely rarely, I will put that mildly, that I talk to an organization who says, yeah, this whole kind of DevOps or cloud or modernization bit just isn't for us. We're not going to do it. And usually when I hear that from someone, I will then go and look at their open job roles on their job site and see that they've got a dozen open DevOps engineers and a dozen open cloud engineering roles.
If you're in denial about it, it's still happening, pal.
Exactly. Yep. That's exactly it.
So I guess the obvious question is, what are the key lessons? What are the key, what's the overall gist of how you do move to this all singing, all dancing DevOps model in a way that's not going to, make you cry?
I think so much of it is, and this very much veers into cliche territory when you sum it up into one or two sentences, but it really is that kind of that cliche of going from a gatekeeper blocking mentality to thinking about, look, change is going to happen. And it's going to happen orders of magnitude faster than we've been used to it happening in the past. And so
you just described the world in general at the moment. But anyway, continue.
You're telling me. I think that's a separate, that should be a separate podcast.
Yeah, like, why is everything going so fast now? Get off my lawn. But exactly. Yeah, go on.
Movies and root shells used to cost a nickel. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
But no, you know, if change is increasing exponentially, our old model of doing security just doesn't work. And I think for some organizations, they have to learn that lesson very painfully. And for others, they are able to kind of recognize that and say, look, we recognize things are changing and we want to adapt as well. But, you know, where should we get started? What are the things that we should change? And that was definitely the position that I found myself in as a CISO going through that shift. And so this was really, this book was kind of the collection of lessons learned out of that, of like, hey, how do you think about restricting capabilities on the operation side? You know, because, you know, the open secret of a lot of DevOps shops is, you know, pretty much everybody has access to everything. And so from the security side, you're thinking about how can I really reduce risk there? And in the kind of old, very gatekeeping model, you think about, okay, well, I reduce risk by shutting off access to everything. But the reality as a CISO is if, you know, you come in and you try to mandate, okay, no one gets access to anything anymore.
Nothing happens anymore, right? Like, that's it. The whole thing stops.
Yeah, you're going to find yourself on the outside very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because we kind of sound like it almost sounds like absurd, right? You're saying, well, you know, the world is moving so much faster, everything's changing so much more, and, you know, obviously everything's just going in this direction anyway. It sort of sounds like this broad philosophical concept, but it does make sense, right? When you look at the rate of change in business, just generally, and in the market, and you look at even the competitive pressure that organizations like banks are facing from startups and newcomers like Monzo, you know, very agile, smaller sort of organizations. And, you know, if you're going to survive, you need to be able to react, you need to be able to change, and, you know, your technology needs to be able to reflect that. And if that's where you want to go, it has to be DevOps, right? So it is just becoming one of those things that, you know, if you don't want to get eaten by the sharks, you know, you have to do this.
That's, you know, I heard almost the exact same thing echoed by, I was talking to the chief security architect for one of the big financial services firms. And he said something really interesting to me, I thought, which is, you know, none of them are really adopting DevOps because they fear each other. They're adopting DevOps because they fear the fintech startups.
Yeah.
And so that's really pushing change much faster than, you know, the kind of half a dozen really large financial services that, you know, they're not really frightened of each other. They don't really eat each other's market that much at this point. But the kind of emerging fintech startups that have the chance to really potentially impact them, that's what's driving a lot of the cultural change and the technology change as part of that.
Yeah. So I believe you've got a bit of an anecdote involving, you know, this idea of like, just remove access to everything and that'll be fine. I mean, you know, you've learned from your mistakes. This was one of yours, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I've got plenty of high profile mistakes to share with folks here. So that's
great. We like that.
This is definitely one of them, which is when I was first the CISO of a organization really profoundly going through the DevOps shift and kind of pioneering a lot of it, which was Etsy way back when, one of the first things that I really tried to do was very heavily restrict access to production. And it was really around, oh, you know, it kind of looks like a lot of different folks have, you know, SSH access.
Yeah, what are they all doing here? Get them out.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
I did kind of the classic the classic security blunder of, whoa, this looks terrifying. Let me just shut everything down.
Yeah, you did the get off my lawn.
Exactly. I did the get off my lawn. Yeah, there are root shells and lawns for everybody there. And so what I really learned out of that, obviously that did not go nearly as planned, to put it mildly. And what I really learned was kind of a methodology that I then was able to really successfully apply to a bunch of other things like this across the organization. And that methodology was really like, look, people are doing these things not just because they want to shout YOLO and do the most like crazy thing. They're doing it because there's some sort of piece of it that allows them to get their job done. And so my job as a CISO actually is to think about the risk here, but then figure out what is the critical piece of business functionality that they're actually doing I need to determine what that is. Then I need to go, and this is the hard part, build a safe way to do that that actually meets my security, audit, compliance, all of these different requirements, deliver that, and then transition the organization over to that so that then I can shut off that very unsafe way, but in a way that doesn't eliminate the capabilities. And the real way I kind of sum that up is the way I really go into thinking about this now is take away access, not capabilities.
It's interesting. I'm just having flashbacks now to an interview I did in earlier this year, actually, with Travis McPeak at Netflix. And, you know, he created a tool called RepoKid, which is just designed to rein in like AWS permissions, because they had the same problem. You can't just crush everyone's access, but they were over-provisioning. So they created a tool, and they've open sourced it too. People can find that if they look for it, that basically profiles the types of access people want. They assign them sort of likely permissions, and then they just start trimming them back until they've got what they need. But it is one of the curlier problems, isn't it, in the sort of DevOps cloud thing, which is like, how do you provision access? Because there's just so many specific kinds of access that are required in these types of environments by so many people.
That's exactly it. I mean, I think the one that bites all of us at some point or the other is, you know, access to a lot of these systems to try to get access to logs. Because if you're trying to debug an issue or, you know, figure out what's going on in some sort of environment.
Well, and then you've got to hope that they're actually turned on, right? Because that's not always the case.
Exactly. There's a separate issue. Yeah, exactly. But I think the lesson that we have to learn there is like, okay, well, rather than having to SSH to a box to view logs, like we need to get all those logs back to a central logging repository, whether that's a commercial tool like Splunk or Sumo or something like that, or in, you know, open source tool like Elk or anything there. But really getting to, hey, what are the tasks that someone needed to do unsafely? And how can we make the default? The default should be the super safe version that allows them to get their job done, so that the unsafe version is, you know, in a perfect world, would never happen. In the real world that we actually live in, the end state is to get those unsafe actions to such a point that they're so rare that it can set off all sorts of alarms when it happens, and you can really tightly control that.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So that's where you wound up with it, I guess, at Etsy. Was you tried the heavy-handed approach, and then you thought, okay, well, I'm going to get knifed in the cafeteria if I don't rethink this. So, I mean, but it is a big problem, right? I mean, how did you even begin? Did you build automation around that, or like, did you just have to go through the pain of talking to like literally everyone and paring back their access?
Yeah, you know, in that particular case, and it's the one that I describe in the book too, like that one was really focused around that kind of classic logging issue where then you pull it all back to Splunk or to Elk or whatever and get people over to that. And ultimately, if you do it right, like a lot of times the way in which people are doing this unsafe action isn't the way they want to be doing it either. It's probably like not a way that, you know, is very user-friendly.
I think this just all comes down to the fact that, you know, with DevOps, and this is the case, you know, you've got easily replicable environments. You don't need to be doing shit in production. You just don't.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, as we get to, you know, a world where it's a lot of immutable containers that are cycling super rapidly, that, you know, that whole kind of environment just goes away. I think for every enterprise on the planet, though, we're all a long way from that world. But you know, I'm hopeful for the future.
Yeah. Now, look, you know, you often speak about your time at Etsy because, you know, this was really your big moment in your career. You'd worked in pen testing, you'd done all that consulting and stuff, and then you went off and tried being in-house and really led the charge to the DevOps environment, learned a lot. And that's, of course, how you wound up founding Signal Sciences. And it's interesting to me because, you know, even though you're years into this now, you're still thinking of new ideas and new tools. And I'm guessing a lot of that is because of customer feedback, but also a lot of it is, you know, some of that customer feedback is going to resonate with you because you have yourself actually been there as a practitioner. So, you're making decisions based on the feedback and based on your experience. One thing that we're going to talk about today is this idea of you've got a new tool coming out called NLX, and we spoke about it a little bit before we started the interview. But why don't you tell us, you know, in a broad sense, what NLX is all about?
Yeah. So, I mean, to your previous point, that's exactly it, right? So much of what we have built out of Signal Sciences to date and what we're building into the future here comes out of being practitioners ourselves, right? We really We did not wake up one day and say, man, it would be super exciting to be a vendor. quite the opposite. It's that we really had to solve these problems in-house. And so we eventually saw so many of our peers going through the exact same issues that we stepped out to really solve those issues.
Well, that is the security industry in 2018. Thank God it's finally there.
Yeah. But,
I mean, I had some guys, Airlock Digital, right? Who were people working in the Australian government trying to implement mandated whitelisting and realized that everything sucked at doing that. So they went out and, you know, made their own, and now they're a vendor, right? So it's good.
I mean, this is the number one way in which I search for vendors to use myself is to go to their about page and see if any of their founding team or exec team have actually been practitioners and not just spent their entire career on the vendor side.
People forget, right? Like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there were no practitioners working for vendors, right?
Exactly.
They were like computer science grads who'd been working at Symantec for 10 years, you know? But anyway, enough. That's enough kicking Symantec for a day.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your larger point there, it's something I'm really excited about too. I think we're seeing an entire wave or entire generation of security companies coming out that come from being practitioners themselves. And I couldn't be happier about that because... Yeah. You know,
tools to solve problems. Who'd have thought that would be a viable industry strategy? But there you go. So, this network effect idea, right? This NLX idea. Yeah. Let me see if I can sum it up and get it right. You've often been categorized, much to your chagrin, as a WAF vendor, right? But unlike a lot of WAF vendors, like, you've got most of your clients, the vast majority of them, running in blocking mode, which means you feel that you can actually start sharing data between customers, like attack data, and, you know, glean some useful information from that, much in the same way that we do with malware samples and maybe even some network behaviors and whatever. But you're talking now about creating a product or creating a product function that allows you to actually share meaningful telemetry between users. Is that right? When it comes to application attacks.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the product launches that we're actually doing in the coming weeks, something called NLX, which is exactly as you said. It's less about sharing individual data. Obviously, no customer data gets shared between customers. It's more about sharing blocking decisions and allowing every customer to get the benefit of every other customer. So that, you know, what this really comes out of was during a previous role, seeing a bunch of web attacks happen against us and realizing that, you know, for the malware side and the kind of classic CNCs and all that, there were really kind of automated ways to share that with peers and, you know, other kind of either invite-only groups or other users of other products or anything like that.
Yeah, here's but a C2 domain, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Like, here's a bunch of IOCs, here's a bunch of hatches, here's a bunch of C2 domains and all of that. But if you wanted to share anything that was attacking you at the web layer, whether that was, you know, even just your classic SQL injections, but they're being really intelligent about it through like account takeovers and credential stuffing, through people doing really interesting targeted business logic attacks and trying to abuse your applications, there was no way to really share that with your
peers.
That
is interesting. And just as soon as you said the cred stuffing one, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because attackers have limited, a limited number of IPs they can originate from. I mean, even if they have a botnet, it's a limited number. And, you know, with your install base, you are going to be able to find cred stuffing attacks pretty easily. And if you can share that data across all of your customers, then, hey, that's going to actually get you somewhere.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? And I think what makes it powerful, like really powerful, is both the scale that we're deployed on now. I mean, it's hundreds of billions of requests per month at this point. But then also it's the accuracy, right? Like the dirty secret of WAF was it was always so false positive ridden that the last thing you'd ever want is a network effect, because that would just be compounding false positives. And so the fact that we actually have a fundamentally different approach there that, you know, like you said, I mean, the actual stat, which is completely crazy, I don't expect anybody listening to believe this until they get to try it, but it's 95% of our customers are in full blocking mode for their production traffic. And it's actually true. It's not like a vendor carve out that says, oh, we need 8 months of learning or something like that. It's no learning, no tuning, none of that. They can actually be in blocking mode. And if you can, because we were able to really approach that problem very differently, it meant that this network effect was really possible for the first time. And that was really exciting for me because, yeah, going back to that one example, I mean, there was this one attacker who was really persistent against us, but they had messed up some of their tooling where basically they were leaking that they were attacking all of these other folks at the same time. And so we could see that. We could see them basically just trying to pivot against anyone that they were having success with. And we had to kind of contact our peers manually to warn them and, you know, help them out on that. And it was really kind of the start of this idea of, if we can get some effective coverage at the web layer, and then we can really compound this with a network effect, it's something that really benefits everybody.
So, but what does that look like? I mean, is it just a matter of blocking IPs, or is it about actually blocking distinct tooling? You know, I mean,
yeah, so
that's the thing, right? Like, and if you're going to start blocking at the tooling level, I mean, then your false positive risk kind of does elevate somewhat, right? Because this person's using this funny header and, you know, there's all this attack traffic associated with this funny agent string or whatever. You block on that agent string, but it turns out that, you know, that agent string is also used in a legitimate way by these other tools or whatever. But yeah, so how do you set those thresholds?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, right? The answer is kind of in the question, which is that you need flexibility around all this. Because if you're just blocking on pure IP address too, I mean, you've got an even worse set of problems, which is every corporate proxy, every mobile gateway.
Yep.
And this has been the other laugh problem there, is they've also never been granular on that, right? They've blocked entire IPs, which meant you could never be in blocking mode. So now, you know, you were going to block an entire corporate campus or an entire mobile gateway.
Or some, you know, giant ISP's transparent proxy or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So no, we don't block, we don't like blacklist IPs or anything like that. We don't block on the particular user. What we offer is a bunch of flexibility there around how you want to block on that. And then our default actions on it are really to block on when we detect an attack, not on whether it's just benign traffic coming from an IP that also happens to have, you know, attack traffic coming from it.
Yeah. And so when you say you block, you're just blocking at the application layer, not the network layer.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, everything that we do, we cover the web layer. We are layer 7, whether it's a traditional web application or an API or a microservice, we cover all of that. Sometimes folks deploy us kind of inside the app. Other times folks deploy us inside the web server, like Nginx or IIS or Apache. Other times they deploy us as a software reverse proxy. So not a VM or anything like that, but just they can run our...
You mean as a WAF?
Yeah, exactly.
You just can't say it, can you? You can't say it.
It burns. It burns, man.
Yeah, your co-founder and CEO, Andrew, and I have had a laugh about your inability to accept that you've been categorized as WAF, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think kind of in the same way, like, because we're doing to the legacy WAF industry what CrowdStrike, Cylance, Carbon Black really did to the legacy AV industry.
I think that's a fair assessment, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's really in the same way that they are very hesitant to call themselves AV, that's kind of same hesitancy here for me on WAF.
Yeah, it's just like Twitch. So is this thing going to be like, I'm assuming from the way you're talking about it, is this going to be baked into the main sort of Signal Sciences product? Is this an extra module? You know, you've categorized it in notes you've sent to me as a product launch. Is it a product or is it a function being baked into the main, you know, Signal Sciences suite?
Yeah, it's being baked into the main suite, and the customers have the complete flexibility to, you know, do what they want with this and everything here. It's more about announcing this capability.
Is it on by default?
No, not by default, because, you know, same with like WAF blocking mode. Everyone's been so burned in the past that you don't want to bring in a new blocking mode without having people feel very comfortable with that.
Now, you know, as I just mentioned, you did send me some notes before we kicked off this conversation. You're also launching something, I'm sure you focus grouped this one to death, power rules, power rules for Signal Sciences. What do power rules look like, Zane?
This one's pretty exciting too. Also just from I'm taking my Signal Sciences hat off as much as possible here and just speaking from the user perspective, which is that the other big problem I had with WAF was I'd go through all this pain trying to deploy it. And then at the end of the day, it would only ever cover, you know, the OWASP injection issues, the SQL injection and the cross-site scripting and all of those. And so the power rules capabilities that we're launching is really about being able to use us to get coverage over all of these other areas of attack at the web layer. So whether that's the account takeover and the credential stuffing, whether that's the app DDoS, whether that's the application abuse or API misuse, getting coverage over those different areas. And I think actually almost most importantly with that is building it in a way where it's not something that's only designed to be used by security experts.
So hang on, you're talking, if I understand you correctly, I'm guessing this is some sort of stateful, you know, multi-stage detection. Would that be an accurate way to describe it? So if this happens, then this, and then this, then,
yeah, you know, exactly. Like,
Yeah, so it's like a scripted alert, which isn't just like a match on a single thing.
Yeah, where you can kind of combine a whole bunch of arbitrary signals, and now you get why we named the company what we did. But all of these kind of arbitrary signals, from attack signals to anomaly signals to font signals or request signals or anything like that, combine them up in an arbitrary way to get coverage over all of these other different areas. And do it in a way where, this is where kind of a lot of inspiration from Duo, for example, which is take a problem that was really historically a very ugly user experience, right, which was kind of two-factor auth in the past, and bring it in a way that's actually a joy to use. And so that's what we really focused on so much with this launch, is making it in a way where ultimately kind of the vision is developers can be security self-sufficient for their own services, because it's the only way we actually scale as security teams, right, is to bring these capabilities to our development teams, to our DevOps teams, and give them the flexibility to actually be able to protect their services in a lot of ways.
Okay. So, I mean, that sounds great, but let's try to connect that with a concrete real world example, because that's, you know, I find that, people who listen to these things, they're like, oh, that sounds great, you know, sophisticated rule sets and stuff. But like, what's one example of how you might apply this in a Defender context?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you a couple different ones. And actually that speaks to an important side of it as well, which is kind of the escalating thresholds of response for all of these and the flexibility there. So take like account takeover, and let's take app DDoS as two good examples of things that I've very much lived in the past. So for account takeover, and you know, both of these just kind of straightforward examples for the sake of conversation, but take with account takeover, you might want to know, hey, we're supposed to have human users. So if suddenly I see a spike of a dozen people signing in from a data center, you know, that's a little interesting. Maybe send me a message, or either my development team or my security operations team or something like that. Send a message in Slack about that. But now suddenly two dozen of them happen in a few minutes. Okay. That's actually something much more interesting going on. Let's trigger a PagerDuty alert or a VictorOps alert or anything like that to make sure that somebody knows that something is actually happening here. And then let's say maybe 50 of those happen in a few minutes. Okay, let's block them outright while we figure out what's going on.
Are you building this with some sort of scripting language? Are they like, have you written some sort of, you know, scripting language to construct these alerts, or is it pointy clicky? How do you actually set it up?
That's kind of the previous point of making this accessible to everyone, is you go the much more pointy clicky route, right? Rather than saying, hey, here's a brand new vendor scripting language you have to, you know, learn from scratch. It's, hey, here's how to get to the capabilities you need and like the power of scripting languages, but in a UI that actually lets you get it done without having to learn something new.
Yeah. Now, Zane, another thing we're going to talk about today is, you know, in the security industry, we talk often about, pulling the security people left, right? You know, earlier and earlier in the development cycle, you know, getting them back to the code, pulling them left. I guess you've had an interesting thought here, which is, you know, pulling the developers themselves to the right might be a bit of an idea.
Yeah. So I think that, and to be super clear, this is not saying at the expense of the kind of shift left movement, which my takeaway of the shift left movement is let's get security involved earlier and earlier in the process, which I completely agree with.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the inverse, and it's an interesting thing that I haven't heard much discussion on, but the opposite is true as well, which is to get the developers involved further and further along in the right-hand side. That's a great idea too.
Exactly, because I think historically what we've done is we've said, okay, you know, code is going to go through this really long journey to production, right? And it's going to be written, and there's not going to be, historically, there wasn't really any emphasis on security there. And then it would go through QA, you know, go to staging, and then it would eventually get to security as a gate right before production. And then a bunch of bugs would be found or issues would be found and be kicked back to development. And some of those would go through to prod, and some of those would get fixed. And so our kind of industry reaction to that, one side of it was, hey, security should get involved earlier on, which is absolutely true, right? The whole thing about reducing the cost of a bug being discovered in development versus discovered in production, like all of that makes total sense. But at the same time, the part that we didn't really realize at first was that when that code actually went to production, we basically, as an industry, just said, okay, bon voyage, right? Like, it's out there.
Godspeed.
Godspeed, right? And I think that the rise of there's a really strong parallel here, I feel, to the performance monitoring space. So the AppDynamics, the New Relic, the Datadogs of the world, which said, hey, hold on a minute. You know, rather than just trying to profile code up front, you know, really left in the process.
Yeah, I mean, some unexpected stuff can happen in production, right? And putting the developers in front of that just makes so much sense.
That's exactly it. And we're just starting to learn that same lesson for security. And this is so much of something that I feel really passionate about, which is, you know, there's lots of talk of visibility in security now, but this is the area where it really means something to me, which is how do we give development teams and DevOps teams visibility into how people are actually trying to attack and abuse their services? Because when you can do that, you can have just as much of a win as the performance monitoring space had out of that, where they said, look, here's, you know, Datadog, New Relic, AppDynamics, whatever you want to use, but now you can actually see how your code or how your services are behaving in the real world. Security needs that corresponding bit. And that was something that we kind of really had to learn the hard way early on. And really, we were fortunate enough to discover the value of really early on as well. And that's actually a big part of, you know, Signal Sciences as well, is giving folks that visibility. And it's, you know, whether it's through Signal Sciences or anything else, and I think I'm probably the worst pitching on this podcast because I don't actually even talk about us that much. But however you want to get that done, it's something I'd encourage everybody to really think about, which is just as with the importance of shifting left and getting security involved early, you also have to shift right to think about how do we give the development teams and DevOps teams visibility into how their services are being attacked and abused? Because if you can give them that visibility, it's the only way we scale as security organizations.
It's interesting too. You know, and so I've got an interview in the can, and I think this podcast is going to go out before I get a chance to run that. But I did a great chat with Greg Shipley, who is...
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm sure you know Greg, right? Like, he works now for Cyber Reboot, which has been spun out of InQtel. And he's saying it's probably time that we had another attempt at active blocking of attacks on networks, because for the last 10 years or so, we've really constructed security equipment and networks to be like the solution that the security industry has come up with is like detect attack, display alert to a human being, right? And because that's the solution to every problem, basically, you know, we've got that problem of too many alerts. At some point, we need to move beyond, oh, well, we've dumped out a meaningful alert to a human being. That's our job done. Let's go get a cup of coffee. So when we talk about, but then we start having these conversations about visibility, right? It's a little bit different to the idea of an alert, isn't it? The concept of visibility and the concept of alerting, they're not the same thing.
Right. Because I mean, the alerting thing, if the actual scenario was detect a legitimate attack, fire alert, we'd all be in a much better spot, right? The reality is...
Well, not even detect legitimate attack. It's detect, because there are plenty of legitimate attacks that are never going to go anywhere. It's detecting totally. A threatening attack, right? That's the only time you should really be alerted. Detecting an attack that you need to respond to. I think that's where we're falling down a bit.
That's exactly right. And this was, I mean, I'll map this back to kind of the web space and the WAF space. But yeah, I've very much lived that on the infrastructure side as well, because that was the first half of my career. But on the web side, that's always been like the legacy WAF approach, which is spew out an alert for every time somebody attempts a SQL injection. And well, guess what? 100,000 of those is a day on the internet. And so what you really want to be doing is giving much more, you know, deeper actionable insight into, hey, it's not that somebody's attempting an attack here, it's that they're triggering real anomalies in the application. And bringing that visibility not just to a security team, but bring it to the development team that actually owns that service and has the context into how their service is supposed to operate. This was one of those things that, you know, back at Etsy, that really... It genuinely surprised me. It was something I didn't expect to be that useful until I lived through it, which was bringing that kind of visibility out and showing the engineering teams that, and then watching how engaged they actually got. When we could say, oh, this is somebody attacking the new service that you just launched. And they're like, I thought security just handled that for me. Or why would anyone be attacking that? Or how would they even know about it? Suddenly you had real data to back it up. And for so many of us from the security side, you know, you've had those conversations, and it so often it just comes down to, trust me, people are going to be attacking it. But it's a very different conversation when you can bring real visibility to those application owners or service owners or infrastructure owners and give them the visibility into how people are actually trying to abuse those in real time.
Now, one thing that we've been talking about quite a bit on the show lately is this so-called, you know, deception concept, right? Deception. Sure. I hate it as a buzzword, but, you know, that's the debate is settled. That's what we're calling it, okay?
Sure.
So, you know, we've got niche products like, you know, Harun Mia's, you know, Thinx Canary, right? That's a fantastic tool. Then we've got, you know, Rapid7's approach, which is to insert dummy credentials, you know, into an Active Directory. And then, hey, if someone starts using them, you know, you've got a problem and you can pick that up because, you know, you're sort of everywhere as part of their IDR solution. But, you know, another area where deception is sort of showing some interesting potential is in web applications, right? Because you can actually bake some pretty silly stuff into your application that normal users shouldn't see or touch. I'm just wondering, you know what I mean? Like, and that's an area where as a feature, like I don't think as a platform, you know, this has been my line throughout this, you know, the last few months talking about this. I don't see deception as spawning an amazing industry, right? But certainly I can think of companies like Signal Sciences, you know, perhaps using a few little tricks, you know, deception style tricks to actually flag better alerts. I mean, is that something that you're actively looking at or even doing at this stage? Like just messing around with various paths in applications that, you know, if they get touched or fiddled with, you know that it's a human attacker?
It gets really interesting. And first, I actually want to pause and give a shout out on the previous point there to Harun. I mean, if anything Harun makes, you know, is going to be awesome. So him and Thinkst and the Canaries are absolutely awesome.
I've been hands-on with them. They're great. And I think you were a customer, weren't you, at your previous gig? Or had they released them by then?
Yeah, they were just coming out. And yeah, without going into too many details there, yep, absolutely.
I mean, so you were one of his customers who had a couple of late nights after install, were you?
Yeah, I mean, Harun is absolutely awesome. Thinkst is absolutely awesome. I cannot say enough good thing about the Canaries there. And yeah, applying that to your point, applying that concept, it's a really powerful concept. And web is another area where it can be really useful if done right. It's one of those where, you know...
Can you do that as a bolt-on vendor though, or do you need you know, does that need to be something that the application developers need to think about?
It's a mix of both. If you want to do it right, it's really a mix of both. It's a much more advanced usage. It's definitely not one of those that's like right out of the gate. You check the magic box and suddenly it does all these things.
Yeah.
But what I look for on the vendor platform there and how we approach that problem is having a lot of flexibility into the way that you can kind of look at signals in the request or the response or how the application is behaving. Because yeah, you can start to key off of a lot of things of like, hey, that's interesting. That form field should never actually be modified
Yeah. Why is that form field actually getting data in it? Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is that something that you're enabling through your platform or is that something, cause I understand, well, I don't know actually how far left you guys go in terms of like how deeply your platform can get its hooks into an application, but I would have thought that would be a pretty sensible option to give people.
Your gut feeling is spot on there, which is, we have customers doing things like that. Absolutely. It's definitely the more advanced use case. But are they using your software then
to build the alerting on that or?
Yeah, exactly. You build the alerting. It goes back into that kind of the power rules bit and the whole thresholding. And you might say, okay, you know, one or two modifications here, just send us a Slack message. 10 of those appear, trigger a pager duty alert. We really want to see what's going on there.
But I'd imagine, you know, like spidering is going to set off some funny alerts.
This is why production is so much messier than people realize until they've actually lived it. This is why you don't want the out of the box product that claims it's going to set up all of these things for you and then immediately block on anything that triggers it because exactly as you said, the real world is messy, you know.
So I think really what you're saying is this sort of deception approach in web is for the grown-ups at this stage.
It's for the grown-ups, and what you want something that that you can build off of there that has the flexibility to give you coverage over that. But it's definitely not we just flip the checkbox here and suddenly it's magically taken care of.
Zane Lackey, it's been a pleasure to chat to you as always. Looking forward to catching up in at Hacker Summer Camp in a couple of weeks. And look, all fascinating stuff, and we wish you the best of luck with the launch of your O'Reilly book. What's it called?
It's called Building a Modern Security Program.
And when's it coming?
That is a great question. It's a little unclear on an email thread right now, but I think it's actually going to be out by the time this airs.
Okay, well, we wish you the best of luck with that, and also for a smooth launch of these new capabilities in the product. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. We'll speak to you again soon.
Likewise. Absolute pleasure as always. Thanks again for having me on. It's great to chat.
That was Zane Lackey, co-founder and chief security officer at Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. If you have a requirement for some web application security software, like a, you know, WAF type of thing, or, you know, some people call it RASP, Runtime Application Self-Protection, RASP. So if you have a requirement for something like that, do get in touch with Signal Sciences. They're just signalsciences.com. And that is it for this edition of The Soapbox. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.